This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
U-High senior and League of Legends gamer Caleb Gonzalez says he thinks of video games as a way to get college scholarships.
This is a really fast-growing industry that it can happen in spurts, and it can happen a lot quicker than playing sports for all your life.
GLT's Eric Stock previews the first esports tournament coming to Grossinger Motors Arena this weekend. Plus, a furniture salesman taps his poetic muse and versifies about McLean County. Mike McCurdy and Patrick Murphy talk about the ups and downs of squirrels on GLT's Grow. And arts correspondent Laura Kennedy chats with GLT culture maven Sherry Zeck as we head into movie award season. The word of the day for them is remake.
All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. High school sports have opened many doors for student-athletes to pursue a free education in college, but the latest sports craze on many college campuses, and now some high schools, requires no real athletic activity at all. It requires skills of a different sort. GLT's Eric Stock tells us about the latest sport coming to Bloomington's Grossinger Motors Arena, esports.
Zach Gilbert has been a video game fanatic as long as he can remember.
I played some video games, but I played, Super Mario Brothers. I didn't play it on a console. I went to the bowling alley and played it in the arcade. So I spent a lot of time playing arcade games. That's kind of where I spent a lot of my quarters and time.
Gilbert grew up to become a teacher. After 21 years in Unit 5, Gilbert now teaches 5th and 6th grade social studies at Thomas Metcalf School in Normal. He says he's still an avid video game player, but now these games have become much more than just a pastime. For some schools like U-High, it's become an after-school activity and a competitive sport. Gilbert helped organize the program at U-High, which has grown to nearly 30 students. Some play competitively, most play for recreation. A group of competitive gamers will be representing the Pioneers in the first esports tournament that's coming to Bloomington's Grossinger Motors Arena on Friday and Saturday. The tournament is called the 66 Games, a nod to historic Route 66. It'll include 16 college teams, including Illinois State's Redbird Esports, Illinois Wesleyan University, and Heartland Community College. U-High will be among 8 high schools competing. There will be team and individual winners in this multiplayer online game. The game of choice at this tournament is League of Legends, which the students were practicing during a recent after-school visit. Gilbert explains the concept behind League of Legends.
You have two teams, 5-on-5, and you're trying to capture the enemy's territory. And there are over 100 different characters in the game, and they all have different skill sets. And, it's just, you think about basketball. You think 5-on-5 basketball.
The major difference, instead of a ball, players use magical powers to take down their enemies. Caleb Gonzalez is a League of Legends gamer at U-High. He plays football and baseball, too, but says he has a passion for video games, and he saw League of Legends as a growing industry that likely offered a more realistic and safer potential for gaining a college scholarship than by playing traditional sports.
There's a lot of Big Ten schools that have been setting up complexes for video games, and I certainly think it's a step towards the future. It's a way to acknowledge another side of the population doesn't necessarily play sports as much as others do and are talented at other things.
While esports don't present the physical challenges that most sports do, the games challenge your motor skills and sharpen your mind.
Yeah, what people don't understand about video games is it's a lot of patterns and numbers. Really, it's understanding the game. Just like you play a sport, there comes practice with sports and there comes practice with video games. And understanding how the game works in and out and understanding the numbers you have to crunch to make the play or to move your character is something that I think a lot of people take for video games is a little underrated.
For several U-High gamers, their sport of choice is the Rocket League. It's 3-on-3 soccer with cars. Senior Boston Cooper plays this game among his extracurricular activities, which also includes marching band, speech, and track and field. He's also president of UHI's Black Student Union. Cooper says he likes competitive gaming in part because he can go at his own pace.
This is a lot more laid back than the other ones. Like with the other ones, the coaches, like, you know, sometimes get very, like, pushing you to always do your best. With Mr. Gilbert, he, like, just knows that we're here to do this and to have fun.
Cooper says Rocket League is easy to learn, hard to master, but it features the team components that all the other sports provide, while the hand-eye coordination helps him with Rec League baseball he plays in the summer. Cooper says he plans to attend a four-year college, possibly medical school, and while he'd like to play esports in college, it's not something he's pursuing. These esports games are not just a boys' club. UHI supervisor Zach Gilbert says more than a half dozen students who play the video game Smash Brothers at school are female.
Having two daughters of my own, that's one thing that, you know, I'd like to see more of. My youngest, actually a freshman here at UHI, if we were playing Fortnite, she'd be all about it.
Gilbert noted as a lifelong gamer, he suffers from ADHD. But he bristles at the idea that playing these games might contribute to a shortened attention span. In his students, he sees an ability to hyper-focus when they are doing what they enjoy.
These kids are really, really smart. But for them, they are able to have that attention just like anybody that's playing in any type of sport or athletic competition. Mm-hmm. And keep that focus on what's going on in the game, but then they also have to communicate.
Esports can also be a spectator sport. At least that's what Grossinger Motors Arena managers are counting on. League of Legends tournaments have filled some of the biggest arenas in the U.S.
And I think that's one of the reasons why colleges and universities and the IHSA is they're interested in it. It's like, hey, we could not only can we get kids that might not be involved in athletics, you know, in any other way, get them involved and bring them in. Which I would have been one of them if this was around when I was a kid. And, you know, you're going to be filling up some stadiums.
The arena floor will include 100 PCs for game competitors, while the tournament will be streamed live online and on social media. I'm Eric Stock.
Tickets for the eSports tournament this Friday and Saturday cost $10 for adults, $5 for children, and 12 and under. They can be purchased at Grossinger Motors Arena box office.
Support for GLT comes from Community Players Theater, presenting Little Women, following the lives, loves, and tribulations of sisters growing up during the Civil War, based on the classic novel, running two weekends in January. Details and tickets at communityplayers.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come on the show, love them or hate them, squirrels affect your backyard. It's GLT's Grow. Preventive care is critical for public health, but for some underrepresented communities, health care can be a challenge.
And we know when we've been patronized, put down, you know, avoided, subtly disrespected. And people don't want to go through that mess. So we avoid it.
For some African Americans, resistance to see a doctor is compounded by discrimination and history, with devastating results. As Steph Whiteside reports for Illinois Newsroom, health groups in Illinois are taking steps to rebuild that trust and improve access to care.
Raheem Khalil owns a beauty supply store in Carbondale. He also has a degree in social work. Feeling disrespected by the medical system is something he's experienced himself.
I was kind of concerned. My brother, he had a lot of illnesses. And so when they brought him in, first thing they was talking about is hospice. And they was just kicking him to the curb. I said, whoa, hospice? And they explained it to me. Why is hospice needed? You didn't tell me his condition or anything. All you telling me that y'all getting ready to pull the cord.
Khalil's brother did end up going to hospice. But Khalil had to ask the doctor to explain why he was making that recommendation and what exactly was going on. It's a fear rooted in a history of racism. The infamous Tuskegee experiment is just one example. It lasted 40 years and withheld treatment from unsuspecting black men with syphilis.
Tuskegee, slavery. We had one piece of garbage that used to use female slaves. They used slaves a lot for the experiments.
The man he refers to is J. Marion Sims, the so-called father of gynecology. He developed his technique by operating on female slaves without anesthesia. Even today, Black Americans are disproportionately enrolled in studies that don't require patient consent.
It was a cultural distrust within the African American community of past history of the medical community experimenting on African Americans and treating them differently from the rest of the community.
Greg Smith is an outreach coordinator with Southern Illinois Healthcare.
And because of that distrust, it was just always thought you don't go to the doctor unless you are dying.
Black Americans are more likely to develop health conditions at an early age and more likely to die younger than their white counterparts. Access to healthcare could help, but 1/3 of Black Americans say they've faced discrimination at the doctor, and 22% say they've avoided seeking medical care for fear of being discriminated against. For patients, that can mean missing out on important health information. Conditions like high blood pressure and diabetes can be managed and treated if caught early, but the longer someone waits to seek medical care, the more advanced these diseases become, making them more challenging to treat. Angie Bailey also works in community outreach at SIH.
We're seeing more people that, you know, they may be in their 30s or 40s and have a chronic health condition that they never knew they had because they hadn't had those preventative exams.
Khalil credits education for helping him navigate the system, but says doctors could also work on being more informed. Janice Bowie agrees. She is a professor of health, behavior, and society at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
So some will refer to the term cultural humility to at least acknowledge that I am aware that there is some distinction, but that I'm going to at least acknowledge that and try my best as a provider to make sure that I provide care to you that is appropriate and that is comfortable for you.
For groups like Southern Illinois Health and others in the state, that includes bringing health information and services into people's neighborhoods. They're working through partnerships with local schools, businesses, and churches. That's one of the ways Khalil sees health providers trying to reach out to communities around Carbondale. Research shows those kind of community and faith-based health events have been successful in reaching Black communities. But the biggest thing, Khalil says, is education.
Education, and a lot of it. You know, I mean, hands-on education, personal education, you know, come almost to their house. It's okay to call, you know, follow up, you know, get your nurses to call, even visit.
I'm Steph Whiteside, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a public media collaboration covering education, politics, health, and the environment. In the wake of the Me Too movement, there's a debate over how some teaching hospitals treat women's bodies. Women who go under anesthesia at these hospitals may be subject to pelvic exams without even knowing it. In most places, it's legal. Only 6 states, including Illinois, ban these non-consensual exams. Medical schools argue it's necessary to teach students. But U of I law professor Robin Fretwell Wilson wants to make sure women can give explicit consent. Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman asked Wilson about these exams and how often they happen.
Well, we actually don't have terrific data. What we have are accounts from medical students who say, I'm disturbed. Why aren't we having a conversation about this? As in terms of medical ethics, we have residents saying that it was a normal teaching practice. And so we know the practice happens as a teaching matter. We know that often it's not consented to.
Does this happen only during something like a gynecological surgery or other surgeries as well?
Other surgeries as well. In fact, what sparked the opinion editorial and the call for maybe a sustained change was basically a woman reaching out to me from Arizona who went to the hospital for stomach surgery and then is told by a resident after the fact that medical students had done a gynecological exam. Well, there's some distance between your vagina and your stomach that's not necessary to the care that she had received. It was done without her consent. And we hear those stories again and again from usually medical students saying they think that's what happened. Patients often don't know.
So related to that, I mean, Illinois is actually one of 6 states that bans non-consensual pelvic exams. I understand this was a result of public outcry over the issue that goes back to like the 1990s. And then what happened? Did the momentum just kind of fizzle out?
Well, so it seems like it goes in these spurts. There'll be a study or an ethics examination that says we're doing this, and then people go, you've got to be kidding me, right? We've had biomedical ethics for 30, 40 years. Certainly we don't do this. And then the answer back will be usually from students, well, I've been asked to do this, and I didn't feel right about it at the time. And then that will just sort of die out. And maybe laws were sort of passed in the interim. That happened after the Federal Trade Commission had hearings, and there were a set of laws that were passed. But if there isn't oversight by an accrediting body, if there's nobody like looking over the shoulder of attending physicians doing this work with medical students, then I think sometimes the easiest impulse is to say, yeah, what? Nobody will care. We should just get on with it.
And so are you hoping that this issue will get revived, I guess, perhaps now in the wake of the Me Too movement?
I think so. I think sometimes we can make legal changes that are sophisticated, but without that oversight piece, tying it to accreditation, it's hard to operationalize. I think a lot of folks would be deeply, deeply disturbed by knowing that this might have happened to them or could possibly happen to them. So my hope is that we are thinking a lot harder about women's dignity in all kinds of ways, women's capacity and their autonomy. And this should be part of that broader discussion. And like the Me Too movement, I think just, you know, people saying, look, you need to ask, just ask, can be a way that we can get cultural change even when we don't have legal change. We've had this promise of informed consent and promise of autonomy about our bodies for 100 years. We need to make good on it, and we need to make good on it for people who usually are not, you know, in a terribly good position to do that for themselves.
Reporter Christine Herman spoke with U of I Law Professor Robin Fretwell Wilson.
Next time on Ask Me Another, actor Jessica Walter tells us about getting cast on Arrested Development.
All three of us got the part. I said, okay, well, I'm going back to New York. Oh, no, no. They said, no, we could rehearse. I said, I didn't bring all my pills.
So join me, Ophira Eisenberg, for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia. Saturdays at 10 a.m. on GLT. Find a program schedule at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the CH3 Satellite Cafe, the boutique coffee shop from Coffee Hound nestled inside Bloomington Cycle, serving specialty handcrafted beverages. Open 7 to 5 Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 Saturdays, and 9 to 4 Sundays, with ample patio seating at 915 East Washington in Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, we're heading into movie award season, and GLT's arts correspondent Laura Kennedy visits with the GLT culture maven, Sherry Zeck. There's not a lot of in-between on squirrels. People either think they're annoying rodents or they're cute critters and like to have them around. In this edition of our podcast, Grow, GLT's Mike McCurdy and ISU's Patrick Murphy come clean with their affection for the numerous central Illinois species of these nut lovers.
When you think of squirrels, you may first think of the fox squirrel, the usually reddish, bushy-tailed, frisky bird feeder visitor, but there are other species, and they depend on native trees. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University's School of Biological Sciences, and he's the curator of the Fell Arboretum. Murph, thanks for stopping by.
You bet, Mike.
So before we get into the various species of squirrels people can find in central Illinois, and a related listener question, how did you come across this topic of squirrels and native trees?
Well, I think it's because people listen to our program, and Lauren Brown, who I'm going to talk about in his work, along with his son's work, Evan Brown. They've heard us talk about squirrels. They've heard us make little positive references. So he placed some research from a magazine called The Nutshells, Spring 2018 edition. And it has some interesting information about squirrels.
So it's their research.
It's their research.
And so what do we have in Central Illinois?
Well, what I found was very interesting is that there is plenty of evidence of the southern flying squirrel here in Central Illinois, right here in McLean County, and even here on Illinois State University's campus.
Oh, really? There are flying squirrels on the ISU campus.
That's right.
Interesting. So I have a friend who did some camping in West Central Illinois, and he was in a hammock, and through the night, he sensed something flying around, and he could hear it, and finally got his flashlight out, and he could see that they were flying squirrels. So he was astonished.
I think that's why a lot of people may be unaware of their presence, because they are nocturnal. They move around, they eat, they fill their food caches at night, and they typically avoid campfires. They typically avoid, your porch light or your yard lights and things like that, because it interferes with their nocturnal vision.
So we'll talk about flying squirrels a little bit more in a moment, but there are other squirrel species here.
We have
besides the red fox squirrel that I mentioned.
There's a real common eastern fox squirrel. Some places the common name for that is the fox tail squirrel. We have the 13-line ground squirrel.
A chipmunk, basically, right?
And the chipmunk.
Oh.
So the 13-line ground squirrel is a different critter than the eastern chipmunk. So we have both. And one is cute with stripes, and the other one has some dots and no stripes. So they are a little bit different. And those three species, they eat their nuts where they find them, or they take them back to the nest where they live. And that's kind of the big revelation from this study, is that people, myself, Dr. Brown, his son, Dr. Brown, they've found the nut caches, which indicate the presence, because the nut cache is specific to the flying squirrel.
So these are different size squirrels. The flying squirrels aren't the same size as the red squirrels.
They're not, Mike. They're very small. Matter of fact, the black walnut, sometimes the walnut itself is bigger than the skull of the flying squirrel, which makes, again,
so
another
maybe
reason.
Maybe half the size of a fox squirrel.
Yes, much smaller, a little bit bigger than a ground squirrel. But I think that's what's one of the things that fascinates me personally about the squirrels is they manage to get nuts open that are hard for grown men to crack them open. You know, especially if you look at like a buckeye, it's got a horned hull on it. Walnuts are hard to get open, and in antiquity, people would drive cars over them to bust the shells to get to the meat on the inside. But the little squirrel burrows some round, smooth-edged holes in there. But he puts the nuts away, and he might put them away in a place different from where he stays.
So which of these squirrels has the most symbiotic relationship with native trees in the area?
Well, I think Lauren and Evan Brown's writing indicates that the squirrels themselves is one big category. They have a bigger impact on the nut trees in the forest than the insects do.
Hmm.
And along those lines, bigger than the birds do, too.
So a negative or positive impact?
Well, it follows it, and it depends on your point of view. But a lot of times, the squirrels, the flying squirrels, as well as the other ones that are kind of, climbers and ground squirrels, they eat a lot more nuts than the trees lose from, say, insect infestation.
Hmm.
Right. But the squirrel's activity can make the amount of nuts produced ebb and flow also. They have some influence on that.
So maybe there's not an answer to this question. Do squirrels help or hurt trees? Do they propagate saplings by burying nuts and forgetting about them?
They do. The trees in the forest are there partly because of the squirrels. Some of the nuts that are buried by the ground squirrels and the fox squirrels, they never find them, and then they turn into a tree later.
Hmm.
A lot of the nuts, though, from the flying squirrel, they'll never turn into a tree because they're gnawing holes in the outside of the nut.
Or they've been cached somewhere where there's no soil contact.
That's the other part of it, yes.
So what kind of trees are we talking about? What do the squirrels like to eat in Central Illinois?
In this area, the forest that Lauren Brown and Evan Brown examined had the predictable company of a lot of the nut-producing trees, like several varieties of acorn-producing oaks. So you got your black oaks, chinkapin oaks that are much sought after, along with your red oaks, white oak, the state tree, black oak. These all grow here in the Midwest. They grow right here in McLean County. But it also includes the pecans and hickories also, because they're producing a lot of nuts as well.
So let's get to our related question from Gretchen Monte. She's noticed what she calls an acorn deluge this season, and she's heard that oaks have a four-year cycle and that the squirrel population responds accordingly to the increase in food supply. What do you think? Is that it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple points of view on that. One point of view is kind of the biology and botany point of view, and that's the trees, red oak produces acorns over a two-year cycle. And they can have periods of weather where the tree is perceiving stress and they produce a bumper crop, if you will, of nuts that's above and beyond what they normally produce. This is also found with trees that are in domesticated orchards where the tree is starting to outgrow its usefulness. And there's some controlled injury made to the tree to kind of coax it into surviving by producing a lot of extra nuts. This is done in orchards as well for apples and all that great stuff that comes from orchards. When there are a lot of extra nuts, there's more foraging going on by the squirrels, and the squirrel population oftentimes increases after a great big crop of the nuts.
So we would see the squirrel population increase after that big increase in acorns, not in not at the same year.
Right. It would be close together, though, because it only takes about 6 months to make a new squirrel. Yeah.
So do you feed the squirrels, or do you work to prevent them from raiding your feeders?
Well, I practice keeping the trees away from the roof of my home, and in professional practice, I try to manage that, too, to keep the squirrels off of buildings. But other than that, I love them. I love seeing them out there, the movement, the color. It's just a living thing, and they're adorable. I do feed them. I feed them corn.
Yeah, so I feed them corn and peanuts, and frankly, that keeps them out of the feeder, too.
Yeah.
The squirrels have to fight with the blue jays and the crows over the peanuts, but I enjoy feeding feeding the critters as well. If you have any questions about squirrels and native trees or anything in your yard or garden, you can submit them at wglt.org/grow. Next week, we'll talk about seasonal preparation for gardens and yards. Are we talking about vegetable and flower beds, Murph?
We're going to talk about everything that's outside. So if you're a pioneer farmer, if you're a gardener, if you're a vegetable organic grower, we've got some information for everyone to help you avoid some troubles in the spring.
That's Patrick Murphy. I'm Mike McCurdy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Find past episodes of Grow at our website, wglt.org, also where you can subscribe to the Grow podcast. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, poetry of and about McLean County. One of Hollywood's favorite words seems to be remake. It's right up there with money. But is it box office that's driving the remake trend, or does the lack of originality have less to do with filmmakers and more to do with audience desires? As we head into the heart of the movie awards season, GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
If so many films at the multiplex seem like something you've already seen before, it's because you have seen it before. Hollywood is busy churning out remakes. Aladdin, Logan's Run, Mary Poppins, Scarface, Clueless. If it's been done, it will likely be done again. Sherry Zeck is interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and is GLT's culture maven. She says, sure, there's a distressing lack of imagination in Hollywood that helps to drive this lust for remakes. But even more so, producers know that remakes have a built-in audience.
In a way, they're kind of a variation on the series film. You can't make a 109th Star Wars, but you could remake a Star Trek or reboot a Star Trek.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because a remake and a reboot are different things. A remake, I think, sort of stays true to its source material and just retells the tale. A reboot takes it in a different direction, oftentimes something that might be darker or more gritty, like with the case of Spider-Man.
Well, I'm not sure I'd 100% agree with you on that. I think reboot really means it's going to be a series, and remake means a one-off. So I would beg to differ on that,
okay.
Although I do think your observation is apt, that often reboots of these popular series are darker and modernized in some way, but they wouldn't really be reboot if they didn't also still have the heart of what the original was, in a way. So if you had a Star Trek reboot and you didn't have a friendship between Spock and Captain Kirk,
mm-hmm.
or you didn't have Kirk be sort of a renegade adventurer, or you didn't have phasers and the computer voice, and then it really wouldn't be a reboot.
Reboot is something that is far more recent for us, but remakes have been with us for a long, long time.
Oh,
in
yeah.
fact, remakes go back to the silent era. Mary Pickford actually remade Tess of the Storm
yes.
Country, and she made it in 1914 and then remade it in 1922.
Right.
Let's talk more about that impulse to remake movies.
In general, I think the impulse to remake is, on the one hand, something was popular once, it made money once, it can be popular and make money again. There's that. There's also technologies change and attitudes change and a desire to see, well, will that story, will that environment work in a new age 20, 30, 40 years later? I think there is, to that extent, there's a creative impulse there to want to play with something a little bit. You have a good story, let's see how it works in a new environment. And then sooner or later, and I might as well make it sooner, we're going to talk about A Star is Born. And I think A Star is Born, which is a film that's been remade several times.
Yeah, it was in the 30s with Frederick March.
You have everything in the world you want. I hope it'll make you happy.
In the 50s, Judy Garland was in it.
What is it that makes him want to destroy himself?
In the 70s, Barbara Streisand and Kris Kristofferson were in it.
That's pretty. What is it?
Oh, just a little piece I wrote. Keep hoping it'll be a sonata when it grows up.
Make a hell of a song.
And our most recent one, which stars Lady Gaga.
Right.
And Bradley Cooper.
Right.
Can I tell you a secret? I think you might be a songwriter. But don't worry, I won't tell anybody. But I'm not very good at keeping secrets.
I think that is, it's a pretty good story. It's a kind of a story that holds up. And I believe different generations have an urge to see their own stars in good vehicles. And A Star is Born has been a vehicle that has served different generations of stars. And while young people listening to GLT today may go, Kris Kristofferson?
Yeah.
Barbara Streisand?
Oh,
I mean,
dear.
That was a huge deal that the two of them were, it's a terrible movie, by the way.
It is.
But it was a huge deal that the two of them were singing together, were putting a movie together. They came from different genres. There was a lot of press around that that got people into the theaters and made people excited.
So what really drives the need for remakes? Is that studio-driven or is it audience-driven?
To the extent that the two are not completely separable, I will go to the side of it's studio-driven. You know, unless somebody is taking their iPhone and doing A Star is Born with their sister and their little brother in the roles, these are big-budget movies. They only make them if they think that they're going to make a profit. So they do testing and they do guessing and they figure that put Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga on stage together and we're going to have a hit. what could make a hit? Well, there's A Star Is Born. So it's not audience-driven so much as it's the producers, the money people, recognizing that there's an appetite in the audience for particular stars at particular times, for particular stories, environments, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm saying environments. I keep saying environments because I think for Star Trek, for instance, and for sci-fi films, it's not just the characters and the or storylines we want to see again. We also want to visit that world that's been created.
How much does the rise of fan fiction have to do with the need for retelling a story in a new way or focusing on a particular character in a story, like in a spinoff of some sort? Does fan fiction figure into this in any way?
Fan fiction can continue far beyond on the end of a series or after a movie has played out in the movie theaters, and it certainly gives the money people a belief that there's still interest out there and still a sense out there. But also it does expand the world of the particular fiction that's been created. In, you know, Xena, for instance, which five of us still remember.
Xena Warrior Princess?
Xena Warrior Princess,
that's
yes.
Both of us and three other people.
Okay. Xena Warrior Princess had a massive fan fiction. There was an explosion of fan fiction around Xena Warrior Princess. And Missy Good, who was a very popular fanfic writer, got picked up to write a show, write an episode of Xena. But the thing to really that's remarkable about that is that the producers were paying attention to the fan fiction.
Well, when producers do decide, hey, I'm going to do a remake of, say, Tarzan or Ghostbusters or Ben-Hur or Conan, and then these movies go out and they bomb spectacularly and they lose a lot of money. I don't know how they could have gone wrong with Ghostbusters. I actually liked the reboot of Ghostbusters as well, but it didn't do very well. Sherry, how do you make a good remake? Can you take us through, film 101 here, and how do you do that and be successful with it? Because they don't always get it right in Hollywood.
Well, first of all, just because something's a hit doesn't mean it's a good story. There are a lot of factors that make a film a hit at any particular time. So it's not always story, but if you're going to remake something, it better be a good story. It better have a plot and a narrative that is compelling, that is adaptable to a different time period and to different actors and to a different look and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you need to pick the right vehicle that has the right story, and then you need to pick the right actors. Though we are not under a studio system in the way we were 60 years ago, films were built around stars then. Films are still built around stars. So it's about the on-screen talent that you can bring to the picture and whether you've picked a good story. Was Ghostbusters a good story? No. It was a fun film, and it was a fun film in its day, and I think it was a fun film in our day too, quite frankly.
Yes.
But it was not that it was a great story, it was that it was just the right combination of fun, campy, great comedic actors,
and their interaction,
it was
wonderful.
And it was a hit. Yeah.
All right, Sherry, they're remaking movies left and right in Hollywood.
Lack of imagination.
Yes, there we go. What cannot be remade? What cannot be revisited because of cultural changes? I've always thought that, well, it would probably be pretty hard to remake Blazing Saddles, for example.
Yeah, I think you're quite right about that. I think a lot of comedy can't be remade, especially when it's comedy that is, again, it's not a plot-driven movie, right? It's not a story that you can just take and transplant. It's physical humor, it's verbal humor, and those things are often very much temporally located. They don't translate very well, often don't translate well across eras and across generations. So a lot of comedies, I think, would be very difficult. I think other things that are really so of their time. I mean, a favorite movie, which every time I teach it, The Graduate. Great movie. One would think that would be kind of a serviceable plot for a remake. Young man, older woman, young man falls in love with older woman's daughter. But is that really what The Graduate is? No. That plot is not really what makes The Graduate The Graduate. What makes The Graduate a great film is it's a certain expression of the 60s. It's Mike Nichols' direction. It's it's about, through this sexual relationship, rejecting what is expected of our young hero, and yada, 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 yada. I don't think the 2000s care much about those kinds of things that make The Graduate The Graduate. So if you made a movie and called it The Graduate and put current actors in it and just kept those bare bones plot lines, I'm going to tell you it's not a remake. I'm going to tell you you used a few elements, but it's not really a remake because it's a quite different film. So one film that I thought could never be remade and I never wanted to see remade is Mary Poppins. Oh. It was so of the time. Julie Andrews owns that role. And really, Dick Van Dyke, you're going to have somebody else play a role that Dick Van Dyke played. You're crazy. And they did it. And I have been ranting and railing about this ever since I heard about it. Furious that they could desecrate such a classic. But you know, I saw the trailer to it and I started crying. I can't wait to see that movie. Can't wait.
That's Sherry Zeck, interim dean of Milner Library at Illinois State University and GLT's culture maven. Of all the remakes coming out of Hollywood over the decades, there's one that's far and away remade more than any other. It's Romeo and Juliet. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can hear what remake Sherry Zeck would consider heresy in a bonus audio segment at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Poetry comes out in all of us from time to time, and its subjects come from both heart and history. Jim Tosh is a furniture salesman in Bloomington. He fell into poetry a few years ago when he wrote some verses about his dad who passed away before the age of 60. Since then, he's had the writing bug. Tosh has published a baby boomer's book of poems that echo the warp and weft of Bloomington normal existence.
I'm very happy, very pleased to grow up in McLean County. I have a great family. We're a close family. There's a lot of Toshes in McLean County. And I just enjoyed growing up here. As such, I have a lot of friends, you know, I've known for all my life. And we have a lot in common from walking downtown in the 50s and the restaurants from Cotton's Village Inn to the Green Mill to Rudat's, going to the Castle Irving and the Esquire Theaters, all those things we have in common. And I thought because of that and my enjoyment of being in the community and the things we used to do and being a history major, I started there.
Would you read a little bit of your poem, Blooming Grove?
I'd be happy to. From Cake Grove to Blooming Grove in 1822, and then became Bloomington in the next years, 6 years plus two. In the middle of the state, in the middle of the corn, it's the seat of McLean County, and that's where I was born. Bloomington, Illinois, that's my hometown, not Minnesota or Indiana or others of renown. Was traveled by Lincoln for many a year. Gave his lost speech there. Did anyone hear? When Abe was a lawyer back in the day, was friends with Gridley, Davis, and Fell. Our founding fathers, all were they. Then grew a twin, an occasion so formal, and the two began to grow. It was really rather normal. And in the 50s, when I was a kid, would go downtown and walk the square I did. Bats and gloves at Reed's and chili dogs at Kresge's. The change tunnel at Livingston's, boy was that nifty. There was Roland's and Shields and Moe's and Winners. And the restaurants they had, now those were great dinners. And shows on the weekends I so love to see, at the Castle and the Irvin and the Esquire in 3D.
What do those names cause you to think of? What do they evoke in you, the names of the department stores and the restaurants that are bygone?
Well, when I mention Livingston's to everybody, they all remember the change tunnel, where you got where you paid for something, and they would send, if usually cash, they would send it up to the office, where they would make change for you, and they'd send it back down, you know, on a on something that a machine that they'd shoot through the tunnel. Everybody remembers that from my generation, I think. And, of course, all the businesses were downtown on the square, basically. So you remember DeWinter's and places like that. The restaurants were there. I worked at Cotton's Village Inn going through school. And most people remember Cotton's Village Inn mainly because of Cotton. He was a real entrepreneur, and it was a lot of fun working there. I worked at the Illinois House as a bellboy also going through school. You know, anybody that grew up in Bloomington, they were on the square. They went downtown to shop. They ate at the restaurants down there. We can go to Ventura's and Ragusa's, a lot of places growing up. So I remember eating on the second floor of Luca's restaurant when porterhouse steaks were $2.50. That's going back a while.
I find it difficult to believe that that was almost ever the case. But moving on to another aspect of food, any baby boomer's book of poems is going to have the word diet in it. Diet is die with a T.
And thus we go to diet, diet. Where art thou? I've tried and I've tried, but holy cow. 95 books and 12 online, 44 more, and I'll be just fine. If I cut back on this and cut back on that and start on the treadmill, I'll shed some fat. Or should I try Bowflex or jog twice a day? Or walk fast like a robot? Get out of my way. Now I'm counting my points and watching my grams. Only so many calories, no more can I cram. And maybe hypnosis, now that really works. In a couple of sessions, I'll cease all the quirks. Just another 20 pounds, that's all to look good. Feeling good, feeling fine in the neighborhood. Just 10 off the middle, 10 off the behind. I'll be fit as ever, so healthy, so fine. But oops, wait a minute, I almost forgot. Said the same thing last year, before it got hot. Same thing 5 years past, and even back 10. Was it that long ago, when I wanted to begin? Dear diet, what else can I do? I've tried and I've tried to be true. I wish I could get credit for as much as I've tried, but still 20 pounds over. I've laughed till I cried.
Well, every baby boomer is going to sympathize with that. What do you hope comes out of this book for people who read it?
If they can see something in there that they enjoy, that's the main thing to me. Again, being here, I'll be 72 my next birthday, and there's a lot of people between being born and now that I know in McLean County, and I hope they can look back and bring back some fond memories in whatever section of that might come about. So that's the main thing.
Would you share one more with us?
I'd be happy to. I took time to reflect the other day as to why things went this or that way, why the things that we choose to do would have the results we wanted them to. Did we say the right thing or nothing at all? Did we do our best? Did we give it our all? Were we there in times of need? Did we see the signals we need to heed? I've always wondered about such things, to do what you can to avoid the pain. Did I miss the boat? Did I not see? What the hell can you do, turning out not to be? Are we mad? Are we sad? Do we say it ain't so? It's more disappointment the way it didn't go. So learn we must. Life's not always fair. There's sadness, remorse, and sometimes despair. You want the things of family and friends to turn out right, to be the best in the end. For disappointment and sadness come to us all. One form or another, we all get the call. Carry on, forge ahead. Do not hide from thyself. For the other ones, too, may have missed one themselves. It's not a done deal, not over at all. Time to do better for all. Never let the bad outdo the good. Always let the real rise above what would and could. I was really upset, angry, and mad. I couldn't understand why that was the plan. But I'm better now, not really sure why. Just taking pen in hand with words to apply. For now it's time, it's another day. My time will come, I'll find the right way. For life is good, you've just got to say, it will be right again along life's winding way.
Jim Tosh is the author of A Baby Boomer's Book of Poems and a lifelong McLean County resident. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Charlie. I appreciate it.
The book is available at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and BookBaby. Jim Tosh is a former teacher and still a furniture salesman in Bloomington. Coming up tomorrow on GLT Sound Ideas, John Norton will have a profile of the wonderfully named band Trampled by Turtles. The pride of Duluth, Minnesota, has become a national touring group headed for the Castle Theater next week. Let's go out with their song The Middle from the latest album Life is Good on the Open Road. It's Trampled by Turtles, coming tomorrow during Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener support at WGLT.org. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Comment on our Facebook page. We're at WGLT-FM or at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.